I'd like now to welcome Tom Alina. He's professor of peace studies at the University of New Mexico. He's managing partner of Innovations in Justice, and he's here to talk about restorative justice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
We've talked a little bit in the past. What is restorative justice?
Restorative justice, we won't cover in this entire interview, but to give you the Cliff Notes version, so to speak, is a different way of responding to conflict, to violation, to crime. And the focus is rather than on a due process or on a statutory approach as we see in our legal systems and our school discipline systems, we're trying to understand the harm. And where the focus of any sanctioning that goes on in those processes is always looking at how to repair the harm.
So let's look at an example right away.
So it could be as simple as a fight in the schoolyard. We've done many of those types of cases. What's the impact? One of the things we want to find out is what's the impact of the fight on the school community?
And so, okay, you've got two kids who've had a fight.
Mm-hmm.
A so-called bully, somebody punches the other, you get a bloody nose. What next?
What next is typically in a traditional system, we'll suspend one or both of those kids. You know, school policies are such that violence is usually not tolerated. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but the kids don't learn anything from it. And often what we do is we put them right back into a similar situation and we haven't resolved what the fight and the conflict was actually about.
So what if you sit down with those kids and someone will be like, well, he took my catcher's mitt,
mm-hmm.
and he wouldn't give it back, so mm-hmm. I punched him.
Yeah, well, we want to find out the circumstances of the event itself. That's always important. But we also want to, again, understand, as I said earlier, the impact of the taking of the catcher's mitt, the response of the punch, and how did it affect not just these two, but how about other kids? How about other kids who happen to witness this? Is this the type of behavior that affects the school community? And we tend to think it does.
So then how do you actually get those other people involved?
Well, we begin to look at who might be affected by this and what ways they're affected. But we want to push decision-making in a case like this into the hands of the people who have been most impacted. So rather than have the assistant principal step in and suspend the two for 2 days or 3 days, whatever the policy is, we'll want to take a look at, one, the impacts, ways to repair the harm, however, let those repairs come from the people most impacted by it. So the kids themselves would have some influence and decision-making to fix the mess that particularly the two of them had created.
So have you seen this, for example, with school kids in action? Have you been the facilitator? You're a psychologist, so mm-hmm. I would imagine that having an understanding of what might be going on would be helpful if you're facilitating a process like that.
Yeah, many times. Not just in the context of maybe a middle school or a high school, but also in the community where there's conflict, or in the case of an act of delinquency or a crime. We've piloted a lot of this work in Taos on very high-impact crimes, everything from DWI fatalities, gang shooting deaths. Recently did a case of two kids in drug court, one who stabbed and killed the other. So you can see from the range from the school fight all the way up to probably the most impactful type of act, the loss of life, where these types of responses we think have a place inside of traditional justice systems.
So let's start again in terms of looking at specifics with the lower impact thing like the schoolyard fight. So who do you get together in a group and what do you do with them?
Well, we might want to first of all talk to the two kids to see if this is an appropriate way to resolve it. We explain to them the benefits of participating, and then we'll look to see who else might have been impacted. Were there adults impacted? Were there youth impacted? So you're really looking to see.
I know what you're. But what do you actually do? Like, you get people in a group, and what happens?
Well, no, I'm telling you what happens before we get to the group.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a caucusing that goes on. So people, this is a different way of responding to this. Kids understand suspension. They get it. The adults understand it. They get it. What I'm about to describe is fairly new, although it's being used here in Santa Fe in the public schools, at Santa Fe High School particularly. So this is what precedes the circle itself. You never go just too straight to a circle, if you will. And I use the word circle generically here. So we'll do some preparation work to see if it's appropriate. If kids are able to take some responsibility for their part of the behavior, the circle's most appropriate.
How do you determine that?
Well, we will spend a little time. They, you know, the assistant principal or whoever has charge of the discipline might say, this might be a good case for a restorative justice circle. In that particular instance, we'll bring a facilitator in to interview the kids, explain to them what it is, because most people don't know what it is. This is not a normal way of responding. And we'll make some assessments to see if it's appropriate to go forward. Once we do that, we want to inform anybody who's going to be part of the circle. It could be a small group of 4 or 6 people. The parents might come in, so they can be a constructive part of the solution. It could be a rather large circle. I mean, I've done circles of up to 60, 70 people. Not on a case like this, but on a higher level of incident. Once we get to the actual circle, the basic way in which information is conveyed, again, is a big departure from our sense of jurisprudence. We're not presenting facts, you know, and having a jury weigh them, which is what most of us, our concepts of justice are. We're using a basic narrative or storytelling process. We want to know what happened. We want to know how people have been impacted. And we feel the best way to do that is through the use of story. So stories are told. Trust is built. And once we understand the impacts, then we can move to some solutions.
Now you say stories are told, trust is built. Does trust inexorably flow from storytelling?
Inherently, yes. Because what it provides is a framework for what we typically don't see in our systems of justice, and it's called listening. If you know, if you've ever watched television, there's very little listening going on anywhere. There's a lot of talking, but very little active listening to understand someone else's perspective. So, yes, it builds trust just to simply be heard. And this is a venue for which people can speak freely and know that they're actually being listened to by other people.
Now, okay, so you got these kids in the schoolyard, and everybody says their piece, the 2 children, their teachers, the assistant principal, the parents, maybe some other kids who were their friends or not their friends who were in the playground on that day. What happens then?
Well, what we might have, the facilitator might recap the harm that he or she heard. And we often have 2 facilitators in most processes. The process I'm describing actually comes from Aboriginal culture. It's Maori
Australian?
Tradition,
yeah.
Out of New Zealand. And it's called conferencing. We know it as family conferencing. We know it as community conferencing, family group conferencing, community group conferencing. There are many derivations of the process. But the process I'm describing is generically called conferencing. The stage after the storytelling is you recap the harms that actually happened.
As the facilitator, you
As
recap.
The facilitator, that's a role that we would do. We often have the offender speak first. The offending kids in this particular case might speak first. We'll go around the circle. We'll hear from everybody. And at that point, we might come back to the 2 kids after they've heard from others. When they speak, they don't always have the benefit of knowing the impact of their actions. So coming back, having them hear after they've heard from others, usually there's a lot of insights and wisdom at that point.
It sounds like in this process, you need a critical mass of people who aren't in a state of kind of distress or tension. In other words, you need some calm people with vision and some loving and good listening people. If you have a bunch of everybody's mad kind of thing, it won't work.
Well, in a perfect world, Mary Charlotte, that would be great. But that's not reality often. having people be calm and sedate and open and peaceful, you know, these types of acts tend to unsettle people. You know, when your kid gets hit in the face in the schoolyard, parents are likely to come in and feel upset or feel they want to protect their children. Normal human reactions.
So you might be in a situation where the only even reasonably calm people with an overview are the two facilitators.
Well, yes and no. I'd like to think there are a few more there. But the process itself tends to create, relieve some of the tension in the process. Much of the tension often comes from not knowing what's going to happen in the process. So once people get comfortable with it, once they understand it, there's a natural calming that will come into the room at that point. Yeah. And there's once the group begins to work as one, rather than two different sides, you begin to see another layer or another dimension of the calm that you're speaking about.
And then what happens? In other words, there has to be some kind of resolution that everybody goes home with.
Well, ideally, yes. What we're trying to do, again, is understand the harm and then find ways to repair it. So when we sanction, when we do what we call a sanctioning or a consequences part of the process, we're often looking at three things. And you can relate this back not just in this case, but to the courts as well. First and foremost, repair harm to the victim. Now, in this case, we have kind of a mixed culpability type of situation. In some respect, they're both offenders, they're both victims. But first and foremost, you want to repair harm to victims. The second thing you want to do is restore the community, what's the balance that's been lost through the act, to the community itself. What does that look like? And the third piece is what will make the offending party, in this case that we're using, or the two youth, what would make them less likely to do this in the future? What do they need to feel safer so that they have options other than fighting when they're in conflict with each other?
And so give us some sample answers to those questions.
Oh, there are many. The beauty of it is, let me say this out front, is the facilitators don't generate the ideas. They come from the community.
But like, what have you seen? So you get two kids in a fight. How do they come up with, and what do they come up with that would make them less likely to fight in the future?
Well, maybe one kid decides to say he shares the catcher's mitt, you know, that was taken. That might be an option. Maybe they learn some conflict prevention. They go through a peer mediation training program that's being held by the city. I've had circles in these types of cases where the parents begin to take responsibility not for the kids, but for their own actions. In other words, what we often hear in the circle is there were events that led up to this fight. The fight doesn't happen in the vacuum. There were taunting incidents, there were other things, and I've heard many parents say, I've seen these two kids at each other now for the last couple of weeks, and I didn't do anything about it. I didn't step in. I have some shared responsibility on this. I didn't throw the punch. My kid's responsible for that. But maybe there's some things I can do. So we don't just, quote-unquote, sanction the youth. But each of the sanctions looks to repair what we heard in the earlier part of the process. We often see citizens and community people, parents, say, this is what I need to do to make things right.
We're talking to Tom Alina about restorative justice. What happens when you are dealing with kind of messed up family systems where you've got a violent kid who's got an abusive parent or parents who are where there's actually violence in the home?
Which is often the case. I mean, if you think about most of the violence, where do the kids learn it? It's often in the home. It's often on television. I mean, these come from different sources. It doesn't obviate the youth of the choices that he or she made in that situation. But it's always helpful to try to understand the larger context in which it happens. So when you've got situations like that, obviously they're a little bit more complex, a little more difficult, a little more challenging around building the trust I spoke about earlier, because now you're bringing family secrets, if you will, out into a, not a public forum, but a less than a family, closed family system at this point. So there may be steps that happen ahead of time. If there are drug and alcohol issues, I've been in circles where the family who has contributed to the event that their kid acted out on, they've made choices themselves, whether to go into alcohol treatment, to seek counseling. So it can go in a many, many different directions. The important piece is to not use shame as a way of qualifying or coming up with ways of dealing with situations like this. And perhaps one of the best, and I use this with my students at UNM, one of the more interesting illustrations of shame and how it gets used in the criminal and juvenile justice systems, and I would add schools and communities, a fellow by the name of John Braithwaite talks about stigmatizing shame, which pushes out, which humiliates, and he talks about reintegrative shame. Shame with the community, basically, you separate the act from the person. And we all know situations like this. But the reintegrative shame basically says that, you know, you don't get to shoplift or you don't get to punch your friend in the face. We value you and you're an important part of our community. But using violence as a way of responding to this, no, we don't accept it. So the community has an opportunity to assert its value system in a reintegrative way versus a way that the stigmatizing shame that Braithwaite talks about that pushes people out, that stigmatizes in a way, and that to me is not healthy shame. So he distinguishes what we might call healthy shame, which again focuses on behavior, versus unhealthy shame, which tends to stigmatize.
What happens, and I know you have experience in this, when you're not talking about a schoolyard fight, but you're talking about a gang shooting, something where, and I don't want to get into this, you know, innocent victim, because I think that's the model that you're trying to get outside of, but basically somebody who was not involved gets killed in one of these gang situations. What does that look like?
Well, again, it's a lot more challenging work. There's no question about that. But I do think that the same type of structure or process has some application here. A lot of it has to do with some capacity. Again, and it goes back to the earlier case we were just discussing. You have to have some capacity for an offending party to take some degree of responsibility for what they did. So as you amp up the type of behavior, the same type of principle, in my view, might apply. And that is, if someone says, I didn't do this, I'm not guilty, then I'm not sure this is a good process. I think that's where the traditional system has its place. But oftentimes, you know, we find that, in particularly in cases like a gang shooting, again, this is not easy to talk about, but people within a safe environment do want to talk about it. That's been our experiences over the years. So there are ways in which that you can take an elevated type of offense where there's violent behavior. We've used these in cases where there are gang shootings where there's actually been loss of life. And we're able to fashion a process out of that.
What happens afterwards? I mean, not that I'm an expert on gangs in any way, but my understanding is either you're in the life or you're not. Mm-hmm. And if you are, you're not going to change. Mm-hmm. You're going to keep on doing what you have to do mm-hmm. to be part of that gang.
Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I would tend to agree with that assessment that, you know, it's very, very difficult for our youth once they've been initiated and indoctrinated into that culture to step out of it. But many have. And I want to speak to those who actually have and ways in which this process plays a role in that. To be able to see the relationship between their activities and what the outcomes are. And spending time in prison, you know, for something like this is, most of us would agree, is not a particularly great outcome for anybody. So helping to see that cycle, that loop between actions, consequences, and the impact on one's future, oftentimes kids come to that at various points in their lives, but we can provide a vehicle for which that can actually happen that doesn't shame the youth, holds them accountable. And I want to, maybe perhaps we should emphasize this in a case like this, because some of your listeners may think, well, this is just a little get-out-of-jail-free card for these little gangbangers. Well, anything but. This is a way of having to sit with your community and hear the impact of your actions. To hear from the mother of the youth who's no longer with us, how things have affected her, her family, to hear from people in the neighborhood, to hear that. But in a way that doesn't tend to either stigmatize the youth or put the community at risk in terms of retribution. And that's always an issue with gangs, as all of us know. This whole notion of revenge, retaliation, as a way of balancing the scale, so to speak.
What about forgiveness? Does that play a role in this whole process? I mean, I think particularly in this culture, which is not a particularly forgiveness happy culture, it's not something that we Americans like to do compared to other places that I've been. A mother who's lost her son to a gang shooting or her daughter to a gang shooting, I would think in the processes that you go through has her own sense, or the parents have their own sense of anger and vengeance.
Well, and which is particularly human, again. I mean, it is very human. Part of the whole grief and loss process is anger. Forgiveness is often part of the process, but I never, ever prescribe it as being a essential part. People grieve, people heal, people forgive only when they're ready to. And to suggest that this process is really about forgiveness, I think does a disservice to the people involved as well as the process itself. However, having said that, I've seen a great deal of forgiveness come out of these processes. And perhaps I should tell you about a case that where this actually happened. So about 5 years ago, we had a referral on a case involving a young man who ran over his girlfriend while they both had been drinking. 17-year-old victim. The defendant, I believe, was 21 at the time. And the girl died. And it was a horrible case. Got a great deal of publicity in Taos. Very difficult case. And when we got to the actual, so it takes months to put a circle together like this. When we eventually got to the circle, the stories were so powerful. And credit to the victim's mother and father, who were both extraordinary people, did something that I don't think I was capable of doing. And in that process, heard the story of the defendant, told their own stories about what the losses looked like, and at some point in the process were able to say, we can forgive you. Now, is that the norm in a case like that? Absolutely not. But after the circle, and by the way, one of the conditions you were asking earlier about what do sanctioning look like, and that we use the model there called sentencing circles, which comes out of Canada. It's an indigenous process. And in that process, the judge was there, the lawyers are there. There's still a formal sentencing that happens after the circle. In this particular case, it happened several days later. But the community made some recommendations, and the victim's parents wanted some things from the defendant. And one of those was they wanted him to remember what he had done. And also, in an indirect way, be reintegrated back in the community. He did get a prison sentence, which was completely appropriate under those circumstances.
Now, did the restorative justice circle happen before or after the kid was sentenced?
Before he got sentenced, yeah. And this was, imagine about...
But he'd already been tried?
He pled guilty. There was a plea bargain in that case. He pled guilty. A condition of the plea bargain, as per the victims, was they wanted him to face them. They wanted him to know what they had lost. And they knew that it couldn't happen at a formal sentencing. When you think about it, not very much, again, as I stated earlier, not much opportunity for listening at many parts of the criminal justice process.
Now, the young person in that case, he killed his girlfriend while drunk, by mistake, presumably. So, but it still wasn't ruled an accident. The kid went into jail. How do you think, you know, compared to other cases that you've seen where the young person didn't go through a restorative justice process, did this kid fare when he came out?
Well, I'll tell you about that. I think it's pretty important. But let's back up a second to the sanctions. Some of the sanctions that the community wanted, including the victim's parents, were you need to get anger management while you're incarcerated. You need to go through a treatment program. You've got drug and alcohol issues. You need to get your GED, which he had dropped out of high school. And the other really interesting piece was they wanted him, as a condition of his release, to maintain their daughter's descanso. And as your listeners probably know, the descansos are those roadside markings where people in our state die. It was a very ingenious way of, one, having him remember what he's done, and also to reintegrate him back into the community once he got out. So there was a lot of genius in that. He went off to prison, went to Los Lunas, did everything the community asked of him. Part of these were made conditions of the sentence by the judge later as the sentencing, in addition to the term of incarceration. And about a year and a half into the sentence, the victim's mother and father began to visit him in prison. They would drive to Los Lunas to spend time with him to see who he really was. They were concerned that he wasn't just going to buffalo them in the circle that night, and they could see the authentic change in him.
Oh, well, I was wondering, I mean, does that happen in the circle? Somebody doing a bang-up acting job of remorse?
Well, sometimes it can.
Yeah.
I think the other side of the equation is this, is that oftentimes community members or victims come in thinking that the client is play-acting because he doesn't demonstrate the level of remorse that they think is appropriate relative to what their concept of remorse looks like. So, again, remorse is a relative thing, forgiveness, relative thing. Our focus, those are often part of the process, but they're never mandated or even gone after at this point. They have to evolve organically.
We're talking to Tom Alina about restorative justice. Now, you have written a book called Restorative Justice on the College Campus, promoting student growth and responsibility and reawakening the spirit of campus community. That must be actually a pretty good place to practice something like this, because if a kid has gone through the trouble of getting into college and staying there, they have at least something to work with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a more intact community. The other side of it is the community changes every year. You have kids graduate, so the concepts have to be constantly reconstituted, I should say, over time. But when you look at the type of behavior that goes on college campuses, we study different phenomena, you know, misconduct phenomena on campus. And, you know, we saw the things like binge drinking. My colleague David Karp, who's at Skidmore College, and I studied some of this work and studied the restorative work being done at various universities. And we began to catalog how do you respond to binge drinking? Greek hazing that gets out of control, which is a big deal today. Athletic scandals that we frequently hear about. Frankly, I think some of the pro sports could use some of these ideas. Academic issues, date rape on campus. All these are, they're not completely unique to college campuses, but they often represent a lot of the mainstream issues that discipline systems face on campuses.
And so when you do restorative justice work there, does it tend to work pretty well?
Well, the data is pretty compelling. One of the more, I think, enlightened or progressive programs I saw was done at the University of Colorado, that we introduced the concept there in 1997, I believe it was, and it's kind of evolved. And they focus largely now on alcohol-related issues. Everything from underage drinking to minor in possession to the kinds of things that happen on or off campus that are alcohol related, underage uses of ID, fake ID. And they found when they used the restorative process in those cases that 88% of the kids completed their agreements and had no more interactions over a two-year period with the systems, either municipal courts in Boulder, where the university is located, or in the university. So we think it's a pretty compelling way, particularly for kids around alcohol, to just understand the consequences. It's not, again, not a shaming process, but there are effective ways of reaching youth, and at the same time around important issues like substances.
In a way, if you were to boil it all down, what you're doing is cultivating empathy and cultivating an understanding of how your actions affect somebody else.
Yeah, we're building community, basically. I mean, it's a very simple community-building process.
But
we use aberrant or behavior or conflict as the vehicle, as the tool for which you do that.
So in some sense, you have to have community in the first place. So in a place like Taos, which really is a community, It might work better than some place where it's tremendously transient.
Well, yes and no. Perhaps a good example is I went to a community meeting here in Santa Fe, about a month and a half ago, sponsored by one of our city council people, on the two homicides that are on the west side, off of West Alameda, and I saw a community there who were deeply concerned. I saw 300 people who came out, were concerned enough, and I guess frightened enough by these events. So I think, thinking about community, I think we have to stretch our understanding of what it means. A neighborhood in some respects. And again, I want to say these are ways of building community where there is none.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, of just trying to understand the other, and particularly culturally how we get into this.
How do you feel that this restorative justice work could, if it could, benefit our pretty overburdened legal system? Can it take some of the pressure off the court system?
You would think that it could. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the openness of the system to these ideas. The reality is that there's not going to be more funding to do these types of, to enlarge our systems. And that's the only direction they've gone in the past. Many states are experimenting with using this as major alternatives of how you, how you litigate, if you will, or how you, the alternative litigation on everything from low-end offenses to the types of things I was describing earlier. A really good example of this is the state of Vermont. And again, I in no means am trying to compare Vermont with New Mexico, but they had a very innovative social architect, I would call him, who ran the Department of Corrections several years ago. He came up with this idea of community reparative panels. So now, over 90% of the sentencing is not done, of the nonviolent sentencing, I might add, in adult cases, is not done by a judge. It's done by these neighborhood panels. And these are volunteer citizens who do this work. So you see a system that's embraced an idea where the community becomes a central part of it. I don't think we can just continue adding prisons and lawyers and probation officers and judges. That's not reality anymore. I think we're going to have to get a little bit more creative. And the restorative work, I think, has a role to play in that because it's so citizen-driven.
Tal Molina is professor of peace studies at the University of New Mexico. He's managing partner of Innovations in Justice here in Santa Fe. And he has this book called, his book is called Restorative Justice on the College Campus. Well, thanks for being with us, and maybe we can continue the conversation.
I'd like that. Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
My pleasure. I'd like now to welcome back to the program Eric Jantz. He's a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome back, Eric.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So you are involved with some hearings that are going on right now here in Santa Fe involving the pit rule. Is that correct?
Yeah. The New Mexico Oil and Gas Association and Independent Producers Association of New Mexico have petitioned the Oil Conservation Commission to gut the pit rule. This is the rule that was passed back in 2008 that regulates oil and gas waste, stuff like hydrocarbons, toluenes, xylenes, fracking fluids, things like that, and which is protected groundwater and public health in the intervening 4 years.
When we talk about the pit rule, I think of the actual pits that waste from drilling is dumped into, and my understanding of the pit rule is that a big part of it is that you have to line the pits so that that waste doesn't go back into the groundwater. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. The current pit rule, well, there are a number of really good protections for public health and groundwater. One of them is that the pit is lined. The other big one is it encourages and in some cases requires closed-loop systems. And that's a system that uses tanks and recycles the fluids that are usually dumped in the pits. Now, the amendments that the Oil and Gas Association Independent Producers are proposing would not eliminate the requirement for a liner, but they eliminate most of the other protections, and that includes things like where pit burials are sited, so they can be sited very close to groundwater, surface water, schools, and private wells. It also does away with a lot of the background testing requirements and other protections that are really important for protecting New Mexico's groundwater and public health.
To what extent have the provisions of the pit rule been applied? In other words, are people obeying this law already? I mean, it's been 4 years since it was passed. To what extent are you actually seeing it in effect on the ground?
Well, it has been in effect since 2008, and producers have had to live with it since 2008. It's interesting that the environmental protections notwithstanding, and in fact, the environmental protections are working. Since 2008, there hasn't been a single case of groundwater contamination reported, whereas before there were hundreds. Before the pit rule, there were hundreds of cases of groundwater contamination. But the main gripe from industry has been that this is economically infeasible. But the fact of the matter is that rig counts, which is sort of a shorthand way of gauging the health of the oil and gas industry, rig counts are as high as they've been in many, many years, which indicates that people are drilling. And the fact of the matter is that nobody is going to let oil and gas reserves go untapped. As long as the resource is there, the industry's going to be around. That's just the economics of the situation.
Unless, of course, solar and wind and energy storage become so cheap that they actually are competitive and beat those other sources, those other energy sources.
That's the only way it'll happen. As long as Americans are reliant on fossil fuels, there's going to be an oil and gas industry in New Mexico. And as long as the resources are there. Once the resources are tapped, obviously, there won't be people to exploit them. But as long as the resources are there, companies are going to get at it.
I wonder sometimes whether the objections to things like the pit rule and regulation, which at the time it was passed, was already quite a set of compromises, as I understand it, and seemed pretty reasonable and was agreed on by a lot of people, whether opposition to that is really about economics or whether it's really about this kind of attitude, we just don't want anybody to regulate us, period.
I think it's probably the latter. A lot of the national oil and gas industry groups have said that this is a reasonable rule. The pit rule is a reasonable rule. I think that the oil and gas industry in New Mexico is so used to being able to dictate the terms of its operations that when the Oil Conservation Commission in 2008 finally started acting like a regulator rather than a lackey, that it was stuck in their craw. It was a burr in their saddle.
Right, right, right. Well, so what's happening this week? It's Monday through Friday of this week. Are these hearings, and are you calling the public to come out or to make phone calls or letters? What can people do?
So the hearing starts 9 o'clock this morning at Porter Hall at the Wendell Chino Building, 1220 St. Francis. It's where the Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department is. And there are opportunities for public comment every day throughout the week at lunchtime and 4:30, I believe. So we're encouraging people to come out and support the efforts of the folks who are trying to stop these rollbacks. Tell the commission that the Pitt Rule works, that it's not broken, so don't fix it.
So who is in charge of finally making this decision?
The Oil Conservation Commission. It's a three-person commission, including two appointees from the governor. And just a note on that, we've actually asked that one of the commissioners recuse himself because of statements he's made in the past that indicate he may have, that he has, in fact, prejudged the economic issues surrounding the Pitt Rule. He is a coalition partner or a consortium partner with independent producers who, as I said, are a petitioner in this case, and he's helped them with negotiating the Pitt Rule, but has also said that the Pitt Rule, and this was before there was any operational history on the Pitt Rule, would cause great economic distress to small producers.
So is this, in your view, a done deal, or is there a chance for the Pitt Rule to survive?
My feeling is that it's a done deal. However, I think with enough public outcry, the commission may find it politically untenable to give industry what it wants. In the past, this commission has given industry exactly what it's wanted with the horizontal drilling rule and the fracturing fluids chemical disclosure rule, which I might add is the weakest in the nation. But I think with enough public outrage and enough people coming and saying that the Pitt Rule needs to remain, there might be a chance that this commission will see that the public wants it.
So people are encouraged to actually show up physically. And tell us again the location and also your website where people can find out more information.
Certainly. The location is Porter Hall at the Wendell Chino Building, 1220 St. Francis. Hearings start at 9 o'clock every morning from the 14th to the 18th. We encourage people to turn out and visit our website, www.nmelc.org.
And NMELC stands for New Mexico Environmental Law Center, where Eric Jantz is a staff attorney. Eric, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
And I'd like to welcome now to the program Jill Felice. She's founder and program director of Assistance Dogs of the West, and Linda Milanese, who's executive director there. And graduation is this coming Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Greer Garson Theater. Welcome, ladies.
Hi. Thank you.
And I'd also like to introduce the Labrador Retriever, Lee, who is on the floor with her assistance costume. What a wonderful assistance dog.
She is. She's a great assistance dog. She hasn't found her person yet, but she's working on it.
So Assistance Dogs of the West, I think we have you on just about every year to talk about what this group does and to talk about the graduation. But you basically provide dogs for people with various disabilities. What are some of the things that you use the dogs for?
Well, this Wednesday, the dogs that are going to be graduating, we have some interesting dogs graduating this year. We have a dog who does hospice care volunteer work, and that dog is for grief, trauma, and loss. So the whole mission for us is having dogs that can support people in whatever they do in the world, whether they have a disability or if they're helping a person who has a disability.
And so a dog who is a grief, trauma, and loss counselor will ask you how you feel?
In a dog way.
In a dog way.
And help you feel better in a dog way.
It's amazing what I mean, just in terms of that relationship, there are people who somehow find it easier to cry to a dog than to another person or to somehow open up. I don't know why that is.
I think it's because it kind of reminds anyone of their child within, that really amazing creative part inside of them. When you're with a dog, they help you remember and imagine.
So what are some of the other functions that these dogs, roles that these dogs play?
We'll have dogs who are graduating with an occupational therapist, and they are dogs who are co-therapists in a practice. So they are fully trained service dogs who work with a number of different people throughout the day. So instead of just working for one person constantly, they'll be working with 8, 9, 10 people in a day.
Ah, very interesting. Because the model that I've known in the past is people who have basically you own your assistance dog, and that dog will open the cupboards and bring you your keys and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
We have some of them too. And those are mobility assistance dogs. And there are a couple of them that are graduating this year as well. We have one medical alert dog that is graduating this year.
What does that mean?
This particular dog works for a child. And when the child, his particular condition, when it's necessary for the parents to know what's going on with him, the dog will actually alert the mother or the father.
And the dog is able to sense that.
Mm-hmm. Smell it.
Smell it.
Because they've got, of course, a great sense of smell compared to us.
Right. Right.
So what happens at the graduation?
What happens at the graduation? ADW trains dogs for people with disabilities in a very unique way. We use students in the school systems how to train dogs. And we also have after-school programs and summer programs. So the kids who have been working for the last year, and some even children longer than that, they're going to graduate their dogs to the folks who are their new owners. And so it marks a graduation ceremony, a closure for us at ADW, and it starts a beginning for their new work and their new world.
And it must be so great for the kids who are learning to train dogs, because that's a skill not only that you use for the rest of your life, but I think it must be some kind of a discipline for them as well, just as people.
They learn a lot about themselves. They learn about training. They learn how to teach another being, how to learn something. They learn focus. They learn leadership.
Consistency.
Consistency. Oh, it's far-reaching, and when you talk to the kids, one child that I can tell you about, he feels that the reason why he got into the college that he got into was because of Assistance Dogs of the West, and it was about the fact that he had 8 years of doing volunteer service work to put on his resume.
Ah, interesting.
Which kind of separated him out from the rest of the students that were applying to this college. And he said, you know, my grades weren't that great. You know, I wasn't on the forefront of getting into that school. But he really feels that because he chose service, he was able to really excel in getting into the college that he wanted to get into.
Linda Milanese and Jill Felice are with Assistance Dogs of the West. And once again, the graduation is this Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Greer Garson Theater. For more information, you can call the Lenzig box office at 988-1234. A wonderful event and a wonderful group to support. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.